I think the firefighters have really taken it upon themselves to create these other training opportunities. There's more of that going on than there is actual organized training from the department. So it's kind of an incredible movement that we've seen.
This is Code 3, the Firefighters Podcast, hosted by award-winning journalist Scott Orr. Now, here's Scott.
That's right, and I will not let Parkinson stop me. Thank you for joining me today for another edition of Code 3. This is the show that gives you all the information on a firefighting topic you need in about 20 minutes. Now let's get started. If you were among those fortunate enough to be in the audience at the opening of FDIC 2024, you heard something special. I'd say it was a call to arms, maybe a call to take revolutionary action. Chief David Rhodes spoke for about a half hour, laying out his case for a change in the fire service. His main argument? That the fire service has become too risk-averse. That the leaders of departments are so afraid of injuries, and of course lawsuits, that they would prefer that firefighters take no risks of any kind on the fire ground, or even in training. He said that puts citizens in danger. And he said change needs to happen from the bottom up. It sure won't come from the top down. Here to discuss that with me is David Rhodes. Chief Rhodes had nearly four decades in the fire service when he retired from the Atlanta, Georgia Fire Department. He currently serves as the editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering Magazine. He's also the educational director for FDIC. Now, let's face it, you know who he is already. So let's skip the list of credentials and get right to it. David Rhodes joins me now. Welcome back to Code 3.
How's it going, Scott?
It's going pretty well, thanks. Hey, I've seen the video from your opening speech at FDIC this year, and boy, you were fired up, pun intended.
Yeah, wanted to do something a little different this year. Last year was definitely more somber as we were paying tribute to my predecessor who had passed away, Bobby Halton. So it was a lot of memorializing and remembering. And so while it was good, it was very emotional last year. So this year I wanted to make it a lot more fun and engaging. So kind of ramped it up in that area just a little bit.
Wow, you definitely did that. Now, you said there's a fire service culture war in full effect. Tell me what you mean by that.
Years ago, you got your training through either your department, fire academy, your training division, maybe a state or regional training academy, or the National Fire Academy, but all organized and part of the municipal or county, state, federal system. Now it seems that there's a independently run, firefighter-run, private training event two or three times a week across the country. And firefighters have kind of taken training to a different level through these organizations, and they're going beyond just the basics. And that's happened for several reasons. One is training centers being overtaxed and under-resourced. So you're just getting, you know, recruit school or recertification training, and then the standard required training that has to happen every year, but not a lot of room for innovation or expanding those boundaries. So happened, you know, within the last 15, 20 years.
I gather you think that's a good thing.
It is. And, you know, it's like anything else. There's just because it's not affiliated doesn't mean that it's good. Everybody has to make their own decisions about where to go and what training to get. But for the most part, it's good because it's supplementing the basics and it's providing advanced level training in a lot of cases that may not be available to you any other way.
Now, the other side of that culture war, I'm assuming, is the fact that thanks to risk-averse culture in the fire service, we now have a loss of unity and purpose.
Yes, I think that's turning also. I think we've been through the bulk of that. In fact, I was just talking to a couple of guys from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, which put out the the life-saving initiatives 20, 25 years ago, and those are going to be revisited. They're having a meeting this August to revisit those, and both of them, both of the people I spoke to are heavily involved in that, and they agree with some of the assessment that some of those initiatives have been misinterpreted or weren't explained well enough on the front end, but that nobody ever really meant for there to be a lack of priority on the citizen or are searching for citizens. So I think we're making it past the worst of it, but it definitely still exists out there, that there is a lot of places that are extremely risk averse.
It sounds like you're saying the pendulum has swung too far, or maybe it's too much of a knee-jerk reaction. People who get hurt in isolated incidents, then departments suddenly decide that whatever they were doing needs to stop entirely.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It happens. It's not just a fire service issue. It happens anytime something tragic happens. I think I said, the age-old golden rule, the law of unintended consequences, is it's not really a blame game or blaming any one group or any person. It's just everybody had good intentions on bringing safety up and increasing safety in the organizations. But sometimes, yeah, you can take it too far. And in taking it too far, sometimes the unintended consequences is you actually make it worse, since your efforts to make it safer sometimes actually have a reverse effect. And when you stop doing realistic training and won't let your firefighters participate in those activities, you start letting them do fireground activities that you deem as high risk, whether the data supports that or not. Sometimes that's an emotional decision. Then your lack of action makes it more dangerous. Prime example of that is when we started rapid intervention teams. It was like such a focus was put on getting that writ in place that they weren't allowed to do anything else. And so you'd have two guys in the building trying to get a hose up to the second floor. They were killing themselves trying to stretch a line. And then you had two or three guys standing in the front yard waiting to see if something happened so they could go in and rescue. And they just grabbed the line and helped them advance that first line in. They probably could have got the fire knocked out. There wouldn't been any need to jump out the window. So you just have to kind of put a little common sense in it and step back every now and then to reassess what you've done and look for those unintended consequences. They're going to be there no matter what decision you make. So you want to minimize the impact that it has on your overall cost.
Now, let's change gears just a little bit, because I saw where you said that wearing your turnout gear during overhaul was a problem. You seem to have two different solutions for that. One was for developing new tools, which makes sense, but another was simply turning the overhaul over to an outside vendor. But isn't overhaul an integral part of firefighting, really?
It depends on what part of overhaul you're doing. Obviously, you got to make sure that the fire is out and that the situation's under control. And then depending on if the building, let's take, for instance, an apartment building that's going to be reoccupied in some format, then obviously the fire department needs to open up every crook and cranny and make sure that the fire is extinguished before anybody's allowed to occupy other units that weren't involved because of the potential to rekindle. But what I was talking about is like for a single family dwelling or for a commercial building that has fire that's, pretty much destroyed the structure, is that instead of keeping our firefighters on the scene for hours and hours and hours in an unstable building, digging out fire, when there's a potential for a collapse risk, there's potential for lots of exposure to the firefighters, is just call in some heavy equipment and knock the thing down, or call in a private company that is equipped with the right equipment to do that type of construction overhaul. And my point about not wearing the gear is that the gear, the NFPA approved structural firefighting gear, is made to function in an IDLH environment. It's not really made for doing construction work. And so we tell our firefighters, wear your gear, wear your SCBA. Well, even the SCBA is not made for wearing in non-ideal situations. So there's other things. There's supplied air. If you were to go to industry and look at an industrial person that is cleaning out a tank or routine maintenance, they're not wearing a self-contained breathing apparatus. They may have supplied air, but they don't have that 30, 45 pounds on their back, and they don't have structural turnout gear on. They've got like a Tyvek suit or a piece of clothing that is made for the protection level of the hazard they're in. So that was kind of my point. It was a little bit of shock and awe because I know there's no solution. So I definitely was not saying not to wear your gear when you're doing overhaul. That may be the only option right now, but the reason for throwing it out there was just to be thought-provoking and say, you know, we don't have to accept this, even though it's what we have. We can ask for a different level of protection.
So there's a better solution out there somewhere.
Correct.
You tied a risk-averse culture to problems in recruiting. How does that work?
Well, I think people want to do something that's fulfilling and that has meaning. A lot of people look for things to be a part of that are bigger than themselves. That's why people play sports. That's why they join teams. And I think that when the young people today talk to firefighters who are in those environments, I think the firefighters are discouraging them from, you know, coming into the service in some capacity because their experience may not be what it once was. And these young people are looking, they want to be a part of something that's bigger than themselves, that's a part of a team that has an impact on the community. And if you're just going to be there for the purposes of being safe, then they don't really see the benefit in that as a community service. It's more of just a job. And so, and then again, that's not just the fire service. That's law enforcement and any public service and also the military. Everybody's struggling to recruit folks. And a lot of it is a lack of leadership that has trickled down and kind of, I'll say, tied the hands of the operators to where they're not allowed to do what the job was actually intended for them to do.
Oh, so firefighters should become revolutionaries. But how do they do that when mandates come down from the top?
Yeah, and that was another one that, again, you know, got everybody's attention. The revolution that I spoke of was, and to play off the Beatles song, was not one of destruction, but one of involvement, cooperation, and collaboration. And so I think it's good that these folks are having these culture war attitudes, these revolutionary attitudes, and they're doing their training on their own. But they can't stop there if they want to have an impact in the entire fire service. They have to become involved in the processes of developing the policies. And that's at the NFPA level. That's at the local and regional levels of developing their own SOPs. And so I think one of the terms I use was they need to infiltrate the establishments and contribute. And really that's a fancy way of saying get involved in the systems that already exist. And instead of having to violate the policy or even brag about violating the policy, get involved and change the policy to what it needs to be. Because there is a system to do that, and it's not easy and it's not pretty, but there is a system that will allow you the opportunity to have input to change the policies to what they need to be. And, you know, it's a natural evolution as folks get experienced in the job and move up in the ranks. They tend to get more involved in the policies, and then even after they retire, they are members of committees and they stay on those committees for years and years and years, even after they're out of the fire service. And in a lot of cases, they think they're doing good, but they're solving the problems that were in the street 10, 15, 20 years ago that they experienced. And there's not always the voice of the person who's running the calls today on these committees. And my challenge to them to be revolutionary was don't just sit back like everybody else and complain about the standards. take your revolutionary spirit and get involved in fixing or developing policies that match what you're seeing in the street and what needs to happen.
Can you give me an example of where it's been done right?
RIT was one that happened. I think I'd use this one as an example. It was like Mike Lombardo out of Buffalo had developed techniques for firefighter rescue that he called FAST, firefighter assist search techniques, and DART teams. And a lot of people started teaching those techniques as they were exposed to them all across the country. And I was one of them. We went around the country and we taught, but a couple of things is like the only people that would invite us to teach had already kind of bought into it anyway. So they had that mindset. And so they were like-minded in the sense, and we did a lot of good training, and there was, you know, a handful of groups out there doing it. We had the groups at FDIC that were teaching Saving Our Own, Rick Lasky, John Salka, and that group. But you're only reaching a very limited number of people. And it wasn't till Alan Brunicini actually put RIT into a standard, which was at FPA 1500, that it became recognized all across the fire service. So now when that happened, fire chiefs started going to their training chiefs and saying, hey, we need to meet this standard. What are we doing for training on that? And then those training chiefs had to either come to one of the classes that one of the groups were doing and learn about it, and then they brought it back. Over about a 15-year span, that became standard training in recruit class. It was no longer a specialty item training that you had to go to a certain conference to get. And so that's the way you make the change happen across the board. And so now, you know, one of the big issues is, as we're looking at data, we're seeing that a victim has about a 70% chance of survival if they're trapped in a fire, if we get to them and remove them within the first 4 to 6 minutes. Our policies, especially at the local level, have a lot of front-end loaded things that we are supposed to do before we actually initiate a search or go in to rescue somebody. And an exception would be that if somebody's, you know, waving at you at a window or something, then you can forego some of those things. But we do 360 size ups. We lay a water supply. We stretch a line into place and get an interior attack line. We get a backup line. Then we can kind of start doing our interior searching. Well, by the time we do all of that, we're past that 6 minute threshold a lot of times. So we don't have a perfect solution. But those are things that need to be looked at to be addressed even at local policy levels, is what is our game plan and how do we give the citizen the best chance of survival, knowing what we know and still operate in a safe manner or a risk-managing manner.
All right. I'm glad you mentioned Chief Brunicini because it gives me a chance to put you on the spot.
All right.
You said the fire service needs a new Bruno.
Yeah.
Is there anyone out there right now that you'd identify as a successor, Chief Brunicini?
I have not. There's a lot of good folks out there, but nobody, to my knowledge, has really come forward to the extent in having the influence and the relationships and the understanding that he did. I'm sure there's somebody out there, and that was my challenge that if you are out there, don't stay in the wings and in the shadows. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that I don't know that are doing tremendous work, and some of them like to stay behind the scenes and maybe not be as public as Brunicini. But Brunicini used his public reputation for good, and it wasn't just about, you know, marketing himself or becoming a celebrity or whatever. He got to where he got through doing good work and being recognized. So I have not identified that person, but I sure want to. And I want them to be more than one. I'd like for it to be a whole, you know, couple of a dozen of those folks. And that's somebody that can listen to the people who are still running the calls day to day, the captains, lieutenants, firefighters, and understand what they're saying when they're describing the problems that they're encountering, but has the respect of all the institutions, whether it's NFPA, OSHA, the International Association of Fire Chiefs, the National Fallen Firefighters Association, the U.S. Fire Administration, has the respect in that group so that they'll be listened to when they bring these issues forward. So that's the person that I'm looking for.
Okay, so we'll see who emerges as that new leader.
And they don't have to wear the Hawaiian shirt. It's optional.
David Rhodes, thanks for talking with me today on Code 3.
Outstanding. Thanks, Scott.
And there is a link to Chief Rhodes' full speech on our website at code3podcast.com/revolution. If you've not seen it, I strongly suggest you take a look. It's powerful, and it'll make you ask some questions about how things are done. And if you have a new book on firefighting that's out now or about to be published, email me, scott@code3podcast.com. We'll get you on the show to help you promote it. All right, that's it. That's all for this edition of Code 3. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next time with more, and I hope you'll join me. I'm Scott Orr, and until then, stay safe.
To contact us, get more information on today's show, or to subscribe to the podcast, go to code3podcast.com.